Dozens of civilians are killed in fresh Israeli attacks across Gaza as the death toll from regime's genocidal war tops 30,500. Head of the World Health Organization warns children are dying of starvation in Gaza amid serious shortages of food and medical supplies. And Iran slams UN Security Council's silence on Israeli crimes in Gaza as a license for the regime to kill and starve Palestinians. Now more bloodshed in Gaza, where Israeli forces have been running amok for more than 150 days now. In the latest attacks in southern Gaza, the Israeli military targeted several homes in the cities of Khan Yunis and Rafah. Nearly 30 people were killed in the attacks. Regime's naval forces also shelled shores of Beit Lahia in the north, with no reports of casualties yet. But Israeli troops once again opened fire on Palestinians trying to reach an aid truck in central Gaza City, injuring several people. The death toll from U.S.-Israeli onslaught on Gaza since last October has now risen to above 30,500, with nearly 72,000 people injured. Our correspondent Muti Abu Musabe on the ground in central Gaza City of Deir al-Bala updated us earlier on the situation in the war-ravaged territory.
The Israeli occupation forces attacked the Palestinian civilians who were gathering near Al-Kuwait roundabout in the eastern part of Gaza City. Once again, the Israeli occupation forces attacked those Palestinian civilians who are seeking for having any entry or any access for the humanitarian aid and the humanitarian necessities. A Palestinian civilian was reportedly killed. Dozens were injured over that attack. In the meantime, the Israeli occupation forces renewed and maintained their attacks and their airstrikes against several areas of Gaza Strip. Whereas in Rafah City, the Israeli war planes carried out several attacks on the area adjacent to the Egyptian borders. In the meantime, the Israeli occupation forces continued their attacks and their strikes against Khan Yunis City, where the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City witnessed heavy bombardments of the Israeli artillery, where the Israeli occupation forces in the western parts of the same city, Khan Yunis City, exploded and blown up several residential buildings. It's worth mentioning that that at least 33 Palestinian dead bodies were extracted from the destroyed residential buildings and the destroyed Palestinian houses in Khan Yunis City. Massive destruction unfolded in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City.
And the World Health Organization warned children in Gaza hospitals are dying of starvation amid dire shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. Now, the warning came after a WHO mission visited the Al-Auda and Kamal Adwan hospitals in northern Gaza. The Gaza Health Ministry says at least 16 children have died of malnutrition in aid-deprived northern Gaza. Now, since last October, over 13,400 children and nearly 9,000 women have been killed in Israeli attacks. The UN Human Rights Chief has warned the genocidal war in Gaza is a powder keg that could ignite a wider conflict in the region and beyond. The U.S. has used its veto power several times to block UN Security Council resolutions critical of Israel's ongoing onslaught on Gaza. The UN General Assembly has met to examine the U.S. veto of the latest Security Council draft resolution calling for a Gaza ceasefire. Now, Riyad Mansour, head of the Palestinian envoy, gave a speech asking the world to hold Israel responsible for crimes it's committing in Gaza.
Israel cannot be allowed to sit among us, lecturing the rest of the world for rejecting its crimes, attacking the UN and its member states, and undermining regional and international peace and security without consequences. They pass laws adopt budgets, and determine military strategies, allowing and enabling these crimes. The Israeli Prime Minister has boasted about not abiding by decisions of international courts or UN resolutions and of having torpedoed peace efforts. Look at our children. Look at Yazan. Look what agony they are enduring. Dozen more children who died of malnutrition have been identified, and many more have died and are dying in darkness and destitution. Mr. President, our people are no lesser people. Our people are no lesser people, I repeat. Our children are not less worthy. Their lives are not less sacred. The dehumanization we have endured aims at making the killing of our people more acceptable.
And Iran's ambassador to the UN has also slammed the U.S. veto of the Security Council resolution calling for a Gaza ceasefire. Amir Said Irvani says the shameful move is a license to kill and starve Palestinians. The Iranian envoy made the remarks while addressing the UN General Assembly. Irvani said by vetoing resolutions, U.S. continues to vehemently support ongoing Israeli genocide and provide the regime impunity in its assault on civilians. He said the U.S. move flies in the face of global appeals for an end to the Israeli bloodshed and violates the principles of international law. Washington's veto three Security Council resolutions calling for a Gaza ceasefire since October the 7th. The UNRWA chief has warned against a deliberate and concerted Israeli campaign to bring down the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees.
Dismantling UNRWA is short-sighted. By doing so, we will sacrifice an entire generation of children, sowing the seeds of hatred, resentment, and future conflict. The notion that the agency can be dismantled without violating a host of human rights and jeopardizing international peace and security is naive at best.
Excellencies, I'm here today because UNRWA, the United Nations.
Lazzarini said the agency is already at a breaking point and its ability to fulfill its mandate seriously threatened. The UNRWA chief described as unsubstantiated Tel Aviv's allegations that a dozen of the agency's staff members were involved in October 7th operation against Israel. He also called on countries that have stopped funding UNRWA following the Israeli allegations to resume financial assistance. Lazzarini warned that without additional funding, then UNRWA will be in uncharted territory with serious implications for global peace and security. UNRWA says Israeli authorities have extracted forced confessions from its staff by torturing, abusing, and sexually exploiting them during interrogations. And tensions continue to mount across the occupied West Bank as Israeli forces storm Palestinians' administrative capital, Ramallah. At least one Palestinian was killed and several injured and detained by occupation forces. Mona Kandil joined us earlier for your details.
During this one of the Israeli military raids this morning to Al-Am'ani refugee camp north Al-Biri city, the Israelis abducted at least seven Palestinians from Al-Am'ani refugee camp. During the military operation, Israeli forces used excessive force as the Israeli forces are used to. They shot and killed 16-year-old Mustafa Abu Shalbak. He's from the nearby refugee camp of Qalandia, But when the Israeli forces stormed the refugee camp, the Palestinians, the residents of the other areas, came to the refugee camp of Al-Amari in order to prevent the military operation to continue. A number of Palestinians had been wounded. At least 7 Palestinians were detained in addition to the killing of this Palestinian teenager in the Al-Amari refugee camp. During the operation, the Israelis said that at least 2 Israeli forces had been shot and wounded while they raided the Al-Amari refugee camp. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, the Israelis had killed 420 Palestinians since the 7th of October when the Israelis started the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip. So 420 Palestinians were killed here in the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs, today the Israeli forces have detained 55 Palestinians. The majority of those Palestinians were arrested in Al-Khalil. At least 20 Palestinians had been detained. 10 of them were former prisoners. Others were children.
The Lebanese Hezbollah resistance movement has warned any Israeli active aggression against the Arab country will ignite an advanced version of the 33-day war in 2006. The movement's deputy secretary general said at a Beirut conference that resistance fighters will eventually emerge triumphant despite all challenges. Mariam Saleh reports.
Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed the readiness of the Lebanese resistance to face any possible Israeli aggression against Lebanon. He said any Israeli act of aggression would trigger an advanced version of the 2006 war, when the Tel Aviv regime suffered a humiliating defeat at the hands of Hezbollah.
The Zionist enemy continues to threaten us with military aggression. We respond by means of steadfastness, resistance, and retaliatory strikes. We hereby declare that if they commit a foolish act and attack our territories, there would then be a new version of the July 2006 war.
He warned Israelis that Hezbollah would fight in an even more sophisticated manner in any future confrontation, stressing that the outcome will eventually be a victory for the resistance fighters. Sheikh Qasem was speaking at the 6th International Conference for the Union of Resistance Scholars in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. Representatives of the Palestinian resistance factions also stressed that the United States' all-out support for the Israeli warmongering policies has given a cover to the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities as its genocidal Gaza war has marked 150 days. Hamas official Osama Hamdan stressed that Muslim nations are duty-bound to foil U.S.-Israeli plots against war-torn Gaza.
It is the duty of Arabs and Muslims worldwide to take the initiative and foil Israel's conspiracy of starvation. The countries neighboring the Gaza Strip must not stand idly by and should take a concrete measure, especially for Gazans in the north.
Scholars and thinkers from diverse Muslim countries have come together to voice their support for the Palestinian people and the resistance. They sent a message of solidarity for Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as Israel's unbridled and unfazed brutality continues unabated.
50 scholars, top scholars from 25 countries, they are gathered here, and hopefully they will reach to any kind of the solution, kind of support and solidarity for the people.
The Palestinians are sending a very strong message. That look, you be answerable to this. You know, the accountability is not only in Israel who are the murderers, but accountability should also be there among the Muslims. Why are you not doing anything? So that's why Palestinians are giving that voice. They are struggling. They are saying they're going to fight to the end. And therefore, they say, if you want to help, it's your responsibility. It's not we appealing.
With the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza now in its 5th month and over 30,000 civilian fatalities, scholars in Beirut assert that the resistance in the region has no choice but to continue its armed struggle until the final victory.
The Muslim clerics in support of the resistance have stressed through their discussions and meetings here in Beirut that the Palestinian cause is a reason for unity and solidarity. They say the teachings of the Quran have drawn a roadmap for supporting the Palestinian people in their struggle to free a land considered holy to all Muslims. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Yemeni army says it successfully carried out an operation against an Israeli ship in the Arabian Sea. According to the Yemeni army spokesperson, the attack targeted the MSC Sky. Brigadier General Yahya Sadi stressed Yemeni forces will not hesitate to perform more military operations in the Red and Arabian Seas in support of Palestinians. He also said the operations will continue until Israeli aggression stops and the siege on Gaza is lifted. The operation came only hours after Yemeni forces launched ballistic missiles and drones at a number of U.S. warships in the Red Sea. Hundreds of Austrians have once again taken to the streets of the capital, Vienna, to protest U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Demonstrators gathered at Vienna's main square, waving Palestinian flags and holding banners that read "Hands off Rafah" and "Palestinian Lives Matter." The protesters called for an immediate ceasefire and delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza. They also urged a boycott of goods manufactured by businesses linked to Israel. They also condemned the silence of the European Union in the face of Israeli crimes. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Hustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Hunger is particularly acute in the bombed-out northern half of Gaza, including Gaza City, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians remain after the Zionist regime ordered the forced displacement of people from the area a month earlier. Palestinians in the north of Gaza are now starving, as the Zionist regime has prevented the UN from delivering aid there for more than a month. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said that 112 Palestinians were killed and another 760 injured after the Zionist regime forces opened fire toward Palestinians who had gathered to receive food aid in Gaza City recently. The incident, dubbed the Flour Bag Massacre, is one of the deadliest in the past bloody 4.5 months in Gaza, with the death toll climbing past 30,000 recently. The actual number of fatalities since October 7th is likely significantly higher, with thousands of people missing under the rubble of destroyed buildings and others succumbing to disease, starvation and thirst. An engineered famine has taken hold in Gaza, with people resorting to eating wild plants with little nutritional value and animal feed to survive. Abu Bakr Abed, speaking from Gaza, told the Electronic Intifada live stream, "It's been all suffering. It's been all horror." Hundreds of babies are born in Gaza each day, and their parents can't find formula or afford diapers for their newborns, as Abed reported in a recent story for the Electronic Intifada. Abed, who is immunocompromised, said that he has eaten meat probably only once since October 7th, and the lack of access to the nutrition he needs has caused him to be repeatedly sick. The lack of clean water results in regular stomach pain. With a meal typically consisting of just a piece of bread and tomato, Abed said that he's relatively fortunate. One in four people in Gaza currently faces catastrophic levels of food insecurity, according to the United Nations. Hunger is particularly acute in the bombed-out northern half of Gaza, including Gaza City, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians remained after the Zionist regime ordered the forced displacement of people from the areas months earlier. Palestinians in the north of Gaza are now starving as Israel has prevented the UN from delivering aid there for more than a month. Seven children have died from starvation and dehydration at Kamal Adwan Hospital in the north, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza. Life essentials and humanitarian aid are being used as weapons of war in the Zionist regime's military campaign in Gaza, with Israel announcing on October 9th that it had cut off the supply of fuel, electricity, water and food to the territory. Only very limited amounts of aid have been allowed into Gaza since then, for less than what is needed to meet the needs of the now mostly displaced population. In late January, the International Court of Justice ruled that there is a plausible risk of genocide in Gaza, echoing Palestinian human rights groups and several independent UN human rights experts. The court ordered the Zionist regime to halt all genocidal acts, including by taking immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance. The food aid massacre in Gaza City is a flagrant violation of international humanitarian law and fully goes against the International Court of Justice provisional measures ordering the Zionist regime to halt genocidal actions, Petra D. Sutter, a deputy prime minister in Belgium, said recently. The Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that at around 4:30 a.m. recently, Israeli regime tanks shelled a crowd of thousands of hungry civilians who had been waiting hours for aid trucks to arrive. The rights group has documented previous cases in which Israeli regime troops opened fire toward and killed people awaiting aid. Recently, according to Euromed Monitor, after the aid trucks arrived, Palestinian civilians were targeted by Israeli regime shelling and shooting. Numerous people fell from the trucks while attempting to take a bag of flour, the group said, adding, many others were targeted while carrying a carton of canned goods or a bag of flour to feed their starving family members. Ismail Al-Ghul, a reporter with Al Jazeera, said that after opening fire on them, Israeli regime tanks ran over dead and injured people and that ambulances were unable to reach the scene because the roads are totally destroyed. Many of the injured were brought to the Ashrafa hospital, which is only partly functional after being raided by Israeli regime forces last November. With a shortage of medical staff, citizens were left to deal with the injured and attempt to administer first aid themselves, according to Euromed Monitor. Jadallah Al-Shafai, a department head of Ashrafa Hospital, said that the majority of the victims suffered gunshots and shrapnel in the head and upper parts of their bodies. Ashrafai added that they were hit by direct artillery shelling, drone missiles, and gun firing. Videos documenting the incident show people running as shots ring out with an Israeli tank positioned nearby. At least one victim appears to have been shot in his upper torso. Daniel Hagari, the chief Israeli regime military spokesperson, said during a press conference recently that the trucks were part of a convoy carrying aid from Egypt that was screened at the Karam Abu Salem crossing and then entered Gaza for distribution by private contractors. He claimed that tanks were present to secure the humanitarian corridor for the aid convoy and that troops cautiously tried to dispersed people he described as a mob who rushed the truck with a few warning shots. Hagari attempted to deflect responsibility by saying that the tank commander decided to retreat to avoid harm to the thousands of Gazans that were there and claimed no Israeli military strike was conducted toward the aid convoy. He claimed that similar aid operations took place the previous 4 nights without incident. The massacre was applauded by the Zionist regime's public security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and celebrated on popular Hebrew language telegram channels. A majority of Jewish Zionists opposed the transfer of humanitarian aid to Gaza. In a statement published on its telegram channel, the resistance movement Hamas rejected the Israeli regime's spokesperson's claims as baseless lies intended to cover up this heinous crime and to evade widespread international condemnation. Ashraf Al-Ghidra, spokesperson for the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, accused the child killer regime of Israel of carrying out a premeditated massacre. It is not clear who sent the aid trucks, with some people saying that it was a trap. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that Palestinians in the area received phone calls from the Israeli army in recent days ordering them to evacuate to the central and southern parts of the strip in order to receive food and water and avoid starvation. Yosri Al-Ghul, a Palestinian novelist and eyewitness to the massacre, told Al Jazeera that there were no international or any local institutions that said that they sent aid to Gaza City. He said that every day people gather in the area near the Israeli regime tanks in anticipation of aid deliveries. Al-Ghul said, "We are starving. We don't find food, even the food of animals, for about 2 months. Our children are starving. While children die from lack of food, their parents are killed trying to get it for them." Jason Lee, Save the Children's Palestine director, said, adding, "We need a definitive ceasefire immediately," echoing the long-standing call from humanitarian actors operating in Gaza.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, The Viewpoints. Here in the studio, I am with Brother Ali and Sheikh Agha Mohammadi, Islamic scholars and researchers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, brother. Thanks for inviting me to this show.
Democratic countries, we see so much governments all around the country, all around the globe, and most of them are having some of them their own difficulties these days. They say that they have the support of people, but today, this is the question. And also we have some governments, some religious or Islamic governments all around the globe. Both claim that they're having their people support. They have, people all around them. Here today, we're going to discuss these ideas. So I would like to ask your comments on this question. And what do you think?
As you said, talking about democracy, my brother very well elaborated that. Democracy means that people have right to decide for themselves. If you consider that definition, so we see that democracy and any other ruling is considering the issue of rights over about imposing somebody's will over others. So if it is so, the question is that who is going to give rights to people? You know, when you look at the Western and secular democracy, you ask them that when you're talking about the rights, that people have right to choose, people have right to decide, people have these rights that are the foundation, the cornerstone for democracy, where this right is coming from? A simple question is that who said man has a right? So this is one of the fundamental philosophical questions for the law. Islamic democracy, it's a democracy, it's the right for people that this right is given to people from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So it means that this is a gifted right. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Quran says, لَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمَ. We have considered man dignitary, we have dignified man, we gave them honor, and nobody has this right to take away the honor from them. So the right as a human being is given to man by Allah, and nobody has such a right to take it from others. So originally the right to rule over people is for Allah, and Allah has given it to specific individuals to rule in a specific way. This way, there is no way just to bypass the rights of people. In the rights of Allah, and by the authority coming from Allah, that will be a real democracy. When you look at the democracies, look at America, why people talk about we are 99%. Means that we are ignored. In this liberal system which calls itself democracy, as Malcolm X, rahmatullah alayhi, he said, there is no democracy. It is all hypocrisy. It looks like democracy, but what kind of democracy is there that whatever is there for the interest of less than 1% and 99% are ignored?
Okay.
So democracy, which is based on religion, we can prove that, and we're talking about it, it will be real democracy. Of course, we have to discuss what kind of, we don't say, again, I said, we have to bear in mind that religion is a very tricky term.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about religion, which religion we are talking about? Mm-hmm. And this is unfortunately one of the problems that our humanity and human studies suffers a lot. That, for example, they talk about the challenge between religion and science, religion and freedom, religion and what? Whatever literature is created in the West, which is being translated to the others, it's about Christianity and the others. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when they call it religion, then they bring it in the other world and the Islamic world, and they try to apply all those elements against Islam. Mm-hmm. While all these stories are there about Christianity and democracy, Christianity and science, Christianity and whatever. Okay. So religion is a tricky term. So when we are saying the position and the role of religion, very clearly we are talking about Shia Islam. We believe that there is such a thing as political rights for Allah and later on to be given to the Prophet and to the Imams, and that is the real human rights which is given to human being. It's real, nobody can change it, nobody can screw it, nobody can alter it, and it's a real right, but there are ways to establish it.
Okay, so this is...
And here the rights of people is considered, and the democracy also is included, that we can talk about it.
Yeah, okay. So, but something, you know, I want to ask Brother Ali, is this, you know, when someone is talking that I'm, you know, when someone is kind of trying to say that I'm talking from God, I am the, I'm connected, something, things like this arise. So are there any ways, you know, how is it possible? So who is here to deal with it, with this part of it? I mean, when you look at the history, there are people in the history that they say that they claim in a way that they're talking from, even especially in Christianity, you can see that. And then this is really hard to harness them. Do we have the same problem in Shiism or in Islam?
Well, in the Islamic governing system, we say that the pillars are quite clear and vivid. I mean, the pillars that have been based and have been created based on Allah's will are the prophets or the successors of the prophet, let's say in our religion. When we understand what the Islamic system is, the Islamic governing system is, then we can actually look at the pillars of the system, and we can judge then our, I mean, naturally, that whoever claims that he is connected to God is a true claimer or not.
Look, how to verify it?
Yeah, we said that this Islamic system, Islamic governance system, has been taken and adopted from Islamic teachings, the teachings of the Holy Prophet and the city-state of Medina, that has been inherited to the Imams, while they have been to some of them who have taken the power of leadership of the Islamic Ummah, or those who have not been taking the leadership of the Islamic Ummah. And I want to say that the leadership was there, but acceptability of the people and the attention of the people to the leaders is another issue. But for us, it's quite clear that we are following the same governing system that it finds its legitimacy from Allah's side, not from people's side. So any group or any person who claims that he has been elected or selected by people, so he's not representing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Only the ones that have been chosen by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And there is a quite clear proof on their being a messenger of Allah, like the Holy Prophet, or the Imams that have been the successors of the Holy Prophet, and they have been appointed by the Holy Prophet. And this appointment of the Holy Prophet was Allah's appointment, not the Holy Prophet. The Holy Prophet was only a person that transferred the message. So I want to say that it is quite clear that it comes through this system, this lineage, not any other system. So, but what do we do at the time of occultation of Imam Ali salam? Definitely, if this system, this supremacy system, or this system of supreme leadership, or I can call it wilaya, that starts, or mastership, that starts from the Holy Prophet and comes through the lineage of the Imams, at the time of occultation of Imam, is at the hand of Imam himself, because we believe that Imam is alive. And still, the legitimacy of this government is at the hand of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But while we don't have access to him, we follow the same orders of Imam himself, when he says at the time of occultation, when you don't have access to Imam, you need to follow the person who is a knowledgeable person in Islamic principles, and he is a person who is controlling himself and his desires from and pleasures from dangers. So, based on the same guidelines that Imam himself actually defines for ourselves, we follow the person who is, we can call it a public deputy of Imam, if we can transfer, or if we can translate the term in the right manner. So, we want to say that this system, this Islamic system, still finds its legitimacy from Allah's side, from Allah's will. And okay, this, so, but it is being backed by people. And as far as people are backing, the system is working properly.
Okay, stop here for a moment. So we have this people and we have this legitimacy. Which one has the upper hand? I mean, which one should we sacrifice for the other?
As my brother mentioned, we have the qualifications which are mentioned according to the authentic hadiths and also verses of Quran. The Prophet has the authority from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He has the wilaya. النَّبِيُّ أَوْلَى بِالْمُؤْمِنِينَ مِنْ أَنْفُسِهِمْ اللَّهُ declares in Quran. And in the issue of Ghadir, the Prophet first made the people to confess. أَلَسْتُ أَوْلَى بِكُمْ مِنْ أَنْفُسِكُمْ, referring to the very verse that, isn't it that there is priority for me over you to decide? Or in another verse, Allah said, أَلَا فَلَا وَرَبِّكَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ حَتَّى يُحَكِّمُوكَ فِي مَا شَجَرَ بَيْنَهُمْ. O Prophet, tell them, they're not believers unless they accept you in all the disputes among them. Means that you say so, your authority, your demand, they wait for you leaving everything. So then they are the true believers. The authority is given to Imam Ali and after Imam Ali to the Imams. So after the Imams, what we have is the general rules to be mentioned. First of all, they have told us that nobody can claim that he is in a kind of a specific connection with Allah.
Mm.
No one. Anyone who did this, you have to refuse and reject and abandon them. So nobody can say that I have chosen by Allah, Allah sent me, I am connected to Allah, I am in connection to Imam. No. So there are general rules. A person who meets these qualifications, who is learned, who is pious, and all the elements, he has to be brave and so, then he has the right to explain, issue the verdicts and rule over people on behalf of the Imam. And what matters here and what makes it different from the other denominations within Islam, that, you know, when such a right is given to a jurist, this is very limited. Means as long as he is following the creed. A person who is chosen as Waliyul Faqih, if he is about to commit a sin, so something which is proven that it's a sin, then he is automatically dismissed from his position. Even it is not needed to be removed. Mm. Automatically he will be refused and he will be dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no guarantee for anyone. There is no guarantee for any individual. And even if there is a faqih, he is a very pious person, even there is a framework there, you cannot go beyond the framework.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a time, for example, in Christianity, that they were very proud that we don't marry. There is no marriage for us, and we don't get into, you know, any kind of intercourse. So we are very pure. Look at the Muslims; they do their hijab, and the very people today, they come to ratify even homosexuality. So what does it mean? It means that there is a religion that the rules and do's and don'ts are decided by the Pope in what they call it, the consensus of the church. So the consensus of the church, if it's going to ratify LGBT today, then it is legal. But when it comes to us, even a person who is Waliyul Faqih, is a marja, there is a framework. There is a text of Hadith and Quran. He cannot go any further. If he is going to say anything against the text, what happens is that he will lose his authority. He will, even people who accept the faqih as the jurist, as the authority, they know that if he is going to breach any of those limits, the rule will not change. That jurist will lose his position. So you see, the framework is very strong. And it controls the person, the individual. So it is not based and limited in the hand of the individual. Actually, it is in the individual should deal and should behave within the framework which is defined. And this framework will control the individual.
Okay. So
this is the theoretically. And so if you want to come specifically to the system which works inside Iran, even you see that we have more elements on the ground, on the factors, like the council of the experts and the other elements, that they put more control on the jurist who is ruling as
and
the authority.
And those framework you mentioned are, it's a mechanism to guide people, to help people have a better life,
These are some aspects of it. Because right now, we're not talking just about the guiding and teaching. Mm. You're talking about the person who has authority, politically speaking, over society and people to make such decisions, social, political decisions for people. Here, when you're talking about it, the limits are there. So this is the departure point between what we call it Wilayatul Faqih and dictatorship. In dictatorship, the one who is at top, he has the authority to decide whatever he wishes. But in Wilayatul Faqih, Faqih has to apply the creed and the rules of Allah. And if he's going to disobey that rules in any sense, he's dismissed.
And what's the aim?
The aim is short. The happiness, and of course, this is the aim of all systems. Yeah. All systems claim that the political system has two main duties: to establish order and bring prosperity to the nation.
Okay, thank you. Well done. Thank you. Well said. And this is all the time we have. Have a nice time. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to tune in back next time. Bye bye.
Show that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, except Al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها لنا يوم القيامة. أمتي أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
The limelight.
According to the British Retail Consortium, shop thefts in England have more than doubled in the past 3 years, costing retailers some £953 million a year. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. UK shop workers are facing 1,300 incidents of violence and abuse a day and a battle to control brazen acts of shoplifting as pressure mounts on ministers to intervene to protect retail employees. According to the British Retail Consortium, the trade body which represents most major shops retailers in Britain, retailers saw the number of incidents of racial abuse, sexual harassment, physical assaults and threats with weapons rise 50% last year, while thefts more than doubled to 16.7 million incidents. The rise in retail crime has coincided with a period of rampant price inflation, with the cost of everyday goods from eggs to baby formula increasing over the past 2 years at a rate not seen since records began in the 1970s, leaving many families struggling to make ends meet. Some experts argue that efforts to cut labour costs by using technology such as self-checkouts have contributed to the problem, while retailers are blaming a rise in organised crime and scarce police resources. Helen Dickinson, the British Retail Consortium's chief executive, called for police to step up the number of arrests. Helen Dickinson said, despite retailers investing huge sums in crime prevention, violence and abuse against retail workers is climbing. Criminals are being given a free pass to steal goods and to abuse and assault retail colleagues. No one should have to go to work fearing for their safety. The number of thefts has quadrupled on a pre-pandemic levels. Violence and abuse, which fell after a spike during the lockdowns of 2020, have jumped back up and are now three times higher than before the pandemic. The latest figures come after almost 90 retail leaders, including the bosses of Tesco, Sainsbury's, Boots and WH Smith, wrote to the government in October, demanding action on rising retail crime, as they said violent criminals were emptying stores. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered this story and tells us more. Retailers want the British government to introduce a standalone offence of assaulting, threatening or abusing a retail worker, arguing that this would enable police to understand the scale of the issue and send a message that such crimes are being taken seriously. Under a similar law introduced in Scotland in 2021, retail crimes now carry tougher sentences and require police to record all incidents of retail crime and allow the allocation of more resources. Helen Dickinson, the British Retail Consortium's chief executive, said, "Why should our hard-working colleagues south of the border be offered less protection?" Katie Bourne, the Sussex Police and Crime Commissioner, who is the lead for business crime at the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners, said the levels of retail crime being reported were unprecedented, adding, "Every day retail staff are facing the consequences of shoplifting, brazen behaviour, and that's why I have supported the call for a specific offence of assault on a shop worker." She added, "Our courts need to work more efficiently and shoplifters need to be deterred from re-offending." The Co-op, which has more than 2,000 stores across the United Kingdom, said it was installing 200 secure till kiosks, locked cabinets for expensive goods and artificial intelligence technology to monitor self-checkouts in its supermarkets after a 44% surge in retail crime last year. It has also doubled the amount it spends on security guards. Last year, the fashion and homeware retailer Nexus boss Simon Wolfson also said he had seen a rise in shoplifting, which had hit profit margins at Next. That came after John Lewis said it suffered a £12 million year-on-year increase in theft, with its chair, Sharon White, calling shoplifting an epidemic. Paul Gerard from the Co-op said the majority of thefts were by people stealing to sell on goods in large volumes and could be accompanied by threats of abuse. Gerard added, people are being followed home from work. I know of one example where we had to move people for their own safety. He said violent theft happened in city centres and leafy market towns, with professional criminals moving on to other stores if extra security measures were put in place at a favoured target. Co-op stores in some areas were reporting more than two incidents a week, where criminals have jumped over till kiosks to steal cigarettes, lottery cards and cash. However, Paul Gerard said there had been green shoots in the past few months as a result of the government's Retail Crime Action Plan published in October, which includes a police commitment to prioritise attending reports of shoplifting involving violence against a shop worker or where security guards have detained an offender. The plan also involves the more controversial Project Pegasus, under which 10 of the country's biggest retailers, including Marks & Spencer, Boots and Primark, are handing CCTV images to police to be run through databases using facial recognition technology in an effort to identify prolific or potentially dangerous individuals. Paul Gerard said police attendance at incidents at co-op stores had shot up to 60% from 20% in October, which was a real step forward. He said, until October, there was no risk in engaging in that type of activity, and now there is a real risk of being arrested and prosecuted. Recently, a coalition of Britain's largest retail associations, including the British Retail Consortium and the Association of Convenience Stores, sent a letter to every police and crime commissioner in England and Wales, decrying a level of shoplifting that they said was having an enormous financial impact on businesses. They said retailers are facing unprecedented levels of shop theft in their stores, with many now seeing organised looting of their businesses on a regular basis. Yet, the Association of Convenience Stores, which represents more than 30,000 local shops, told the Financial Times that shoplifting in its sector had risen to a level it had never seen before. It argued that the discrepancy between the experience of retailers and official statistics was because of a lack of crimes against business, only 16% by its estimation being reported.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.